William T. Graham et al. Petitioners versus John Deere Company of Kansas City et al. Mr. Gold, you may proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. The patent before this court in this case, generally referred to as a Graham 798 patent because there was another Graham patent that was cited against it, the prior Graham patent. This patent has been held valid twice in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. In the second case before the Fifth Circuit, the same prior art was considered as was considered by the Eighth Circuit in the case that's been brought here by certiorari. The record on page 15 had a stipulation. It was item number 7. That stipulated that the prior art was the same in the Fifth Circuit and the Eighth Circuit. With the same prior art before the two circuits, it necessarily means then that there is a clear difference between the circuits as to their test of patentability or their requirements for patentability. Of course, this brings us to sections 101, 102, and 103 of the Patent Act of 1952. The question primarily is then whether the Eighth Circuit applied the proper test of requirements for patentability when they substituted their judgment for that of the trial court, reversed the trial court, and held the 798 patent invalid. Respondents in their brief on page 27 suggested that petitioners are arguing that section 103 established a statutory test of patentability that changed existing law. We don't quite say that. But we do say that it changed the law as applied by the Eighth Circuit. And we think the Eighth Circuit is wrong in their test and have been for many years. A few brief comments relative to the statute. Since 1790, Congress has enacted patent laws. The first one was entitled an Act to Promote the Progress of Useful Arts. And in that act and in all subsequent patent statutes until 1952 Act, they had statutory requirements for patentability of novelty and utility. There was no other statutory requirements until the 1952 Act. However, this court in 1850 in the Hotchkiss versus Greenwood applied as a requirement of patentability that the invention be more than the work of a mechanic in the art. In other words, in addition to being new and useful, it had to involve a greater degree of skill and ingenuity than that possessed by the ordinary mechanic acquainted with the business. Down through the years, this same rule has been applied to this court with some verbal variance. There's been associated comments in the different opinions, and I believe that some of these comments have been taken up by the lower courts and thereby have departed from what this court has been holding. We say the Eighth Circuit is one that has been doing this. Even prior to 1952, the Eighth Circuit took position that this court had raised the standards of originality necessary to sustain patents. In the record, in this case before the court, on page 925, the Eighth Circuit in its opinion stated, this court has adhered to the position that since Cuno Engineering Corporation versus Automatic Devices Corporation, the amount of originality and ingenuity over and beyond novelty and utility which will constitute invention necessary to sustain a patent for a combination of old elements such as we have here in a crowded art has increased. He also quoted from another case in the Eighth Circuit. As a part of that quotation, they said, the Supreme Court has, we think, raised the standards of originality necessary to sustain patents for improvements such as those involved in the instant cases, regardless of their usefulness or commercial success.
in the beginning. It might, if it does, don't do it. If you could state, succinctly what you claim proper standard is, and what change you claim the Eighth Circuit has made in the standard.
Yes, sir. I can do that, Mr. Justice Black, by referring to that decision, which I was going to do. On page 930 of the record, there is a quotation from the Eighth Circuit case of General Bronze Corporation versus Kupel's. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Volume 5 of the record. The bringing together. 930, Mr. Justice Brennan. The bringing together of old elements in a mechanism involving no new principle to produce an old result, however skillfully done, even though the result marks an advance in efficiency and utility, is but an exercise of mechanical skill and not invention. Now, answering your question, Mr. Justice Black.
Now, that's the one you claim is wrong.
Yes, sir. My point is that they have said that it has to produce a new result in order to be patentable. I don't think that this court, in any of its decisions, has ever said that it had to produce a new result. It has mentioned function, new function, or different function, but never has this court required that a patent produce a new result. The Eighth Circuit, in effect, is saying that if an improvement, a different arrangement of parts, a different operation produces the same result, then automatically it's obvious to anyone skilled in the art or having ordinary skill in the art. We say that is wrong. We say that an invention can be made in a device that produces the same result as another older device and still involve a different structure and be patentable.
You say that, Mr. Gold, because of the decisions of this court or because of Section 103 of the Act or because of both?
Mr. Justice Stewart, I say that we can do that with both.
What do you think?
I think that you'll find in all three of the cases that you have here before you today that the briefs of all the parties have not been greatly in dispute here.
There seems to be basic agreement, largely, as among
yes, sir. That primarily this court has held that in order to be patentable, it has to be beyond the ordinary skill of the man in that art. Some of the wording has been beyond the skill of the calling. We think that the statute, in effect, has the same test of patentability.
Well, that's to say, I gather, Mr. Gold, that however it's phrased, whether in the statute or in the cases, it's really the old Huckins test.
Yes, sir. And I think that in the Cuno case, the AP case, all of the cases before this court, since the Hotchkiss case, has primarily had the same basic holding, that it had to be non-obvious in order to be patentable. And that's, we are agreeing with that. And I think that every one of the parties before this court in these cases are in agreement with that, as I read the briefs and I read all of them. I do say, however, that the Eighth Circuit is one of the departures that was referred to by Congress in their reports in connection with the statute when they said that they hoped that the statute, particularly Section 103, would bring greater uniformity and reduce these departures that had occurred before. We say that the Eighth Circuit has departed and set up their own standard. They have, in effect, placed additional conditions on the statute, and we don't think the Eighth Circuit can do that. They have not followed this court, nor have they followed the statute. They have not even applied the statute in connection with our case. They pay lip service to the statute, but when it comes right down to what they have said in their decision, all they have said is that the finding of the trial court was that we had an improved functional result, and this was not a new result, and therefore the court had not applied the stricter standards of the Eighth Circuit, and so the patent was automatically invalid in that circuit. in order to bolster their opinion, they took the position that even assuming the trial court's finding provided a significant difference or a new result, that they still felt it would be obvious. He made the statement that they were making that assumption on page 931 of the record. I will read the first four lines of the paragraph starting on that page. Furthermore, even assuming that the trial court's findings of a, quote, a slight but significant difference in the flexing of the forward portion of the shank that is not found in the prior art, end quote, can be construed as finding a new result. And then they went on to discuss the case and say that this was an erroneous finding of the lower court. However, I want to call your attention to the fact that after they had discussed what the case and what the structure did, that they then concluded from that assumption that it might provide a new result. While perhaps more efficient, the inversion of the parts so as to allow the shank to flex downwardly away from the plate above it did not bring about a significant new or different result and would have been obvious to a person having ordinary skill in the art. We think that while they made an assumption that it was a new result, they turned right around and said it still doesn't provide a new result, so it's obvious, and that's all they did in their test in which they were applying with that assumption. It is our position that the Eighth Circuit has applied a standard or test and requirements of patentability that they have set up themselves that is stricter than anything that this court has ever applied. It does not comply with the statute, and that this court in its supervisory authority should reverse the court on that point and then help to bring out more uniformity in these decisions on patent cases.
Has the Eighth Circuit expressed a view, I don't believe it did in this case, but has it expressed a view as to the effect of the 1952 Act on the existing patent case law?
Yes, sir. In some of their cases, they have made indications that they felt that the statute made no change. And in each of their decisions, they cite the Cuno case and the AP case as supporting their standard. And I say that they had gone beyond those two cases. If they had applied merely what had been held in the Cuno case or the AP case, then they would have said that if it was beyond the calling of the person skilled in the art at the time of the invention, it would be obvious. But they wouldn't say it had to provide a new result, because neither of those cases say that.
There is not involved in this case, is there, the final sentence of Section 103?
No, sir. The final sentence refers only to the manner in which the invention was made. There's nothing in the record in this case to indicate how it was made, whether it was quickly or whether it involved a long time of experimentation.
Your patent's on a plow?
Yes, sir, Mr. Yeswar.
Improvement of a, in order that it might obviate getting caught in rocks and things like that.
Yes, sir. I will go into that. I want to make one more comment on the statute in the Eighth Circuit, and I'll go right into the plow. I want to call attention to the fact that in the last 15 years, the Eighth Circuit has considered approximately 40 patents, and out of those 40, it has sustained the validity of only six, and in each of those six, there was a trial court finding of a new result. I think that the Eighth Circuit has been consistent throughout all these years, even prior to the statute, of knocking down patents if they did not provide a new result.
How far have they gone? Of course, carried to a ridiculous extreme, that would mean that the electric light was not a patent, because previously that electric light gives light, and so did kerosene lamps.
Mr. Justice Stewart, I think we'll have to say that in this application, we are talking about structures wherein they are made up of a combination of old elements.
It's confined to mechanical combination patents made up of old elements.
Yes,
this doctrine of the eighth.
Yes, sir. I'm not suggesting that it would apply to any other situation. Right. That is a situation in our case.
You stated, as I understand it, that a court would have charged a jury trying a patent case, that the quotation you gave from the opinion, 930, would be an improper instruction that wouldn't give the correct standard. Now, do you have anywhere in writing, or can you give me succinctly, what you say would be a proper charge instead of that for a standard?
Mr. Justice Black, I don't know that I would have anything in writing.
Section 103, wouldn't that be a proper charge to the jury?
Yes, sir. I think it would, Mr. Justice Stewart. It's a question of whether or not the invention, when it was made, would have been obvious to a person having ordinary skill in the art. That is what the statute says. I think that is a different way of saying exactly what this court has held in the Hotchkiss case and in the...
In which case?
Hotchkiss versus Greenwood.
Yes.
And all...
Case.
Yes, sir. And I think it's the same thing that Mr. Justice Douglas said in the Cuno case, that it had to be beyond the skill of the calling at the time of the invention.
Now, that's tried before a jury or a court, without a jury, and goes up to the appellate court, in passing on it, what does that court just, can that court just say, we find that it does not meet this standard? They were wrong, the evidence didn't support it, and therefore we set it aside. That would be the final standard you would suggest.
Yes, sir. Of course, Mr. Justice Black, the way your question was worded, I think it might be a question of whether or not this was a matter of law or a matter of fact. I think that the final decision as to whether or not it involves patentability is a question of law. And so if there was a question of law that was applied by the trial court or by the jury, I think that that could be reversed by the appellate court.
In other words, what you're saying that the clearly erroneous rule is not a limitation upon appellate review in a patent case on the issue of non-obviousness?
On the issue as to patentability, Mr. Justice Harlan, I think that there are facts that have to be considered in arriving at the conclusion. I think that the actual decision as to whether or not it is a valid patent is a conclusion of law.
Your position is you have subsidiary findings, and when you get down to the ultimate question of whether it's patentable, that is a pure question of law.
Yes, sir. Of course, there are questions of fact that definitely should be considered in arriving at that conclusion. I think that in this case that the Court of Appeals in their decision have clearly reversed it on a question of law, that the trial court did not apply the standard, the strict standard, that they admittedly apply in their cases, and therefore did reverse it. The trial court did not find a new result. Now, I would like to go into the patent. I had hoped to use some easels to point this out, but I decided that it would be difficult to see it, and so if I may, I would like to refer to the record, and particularly volume 3, and page 577 shows some drawings of our patent that was in suit. We say that the Eighth Circuit did not actually give consideration to this patent. The structure was new. The respondents admitted in their brief on page 28 that the particular arrangement of the elements shown in the 798 patent was not shown in the prior art. The 798 structure had utility. There was a Jeffroy clamp, plaintiff's exhibit C, which was held to infringe in an earlier suit, and it was stipulated that it was a commercial success. That was stipulation number 4 on the record, page 14. So there's no dispute that a structure such as these clamps and the respondent's clamps also were successful. They were useful. So then we come primarily to a question as to the obviousness of the structure. In talking about that, I would like to comment first on the problem involved. In the wheat countries, they do what they call chisel plowing. These are frames mounted on wheels that have big shanks that go back and rip open the ground. Originally, where there was not much rocks, they had the front end of the shank, which, if you please, is about 2 inches wide and 3/4 to 1 inch thick. They were held immobile on the frame, but they would rip through the ground, and there was some flexibility in the shank back behind the framework. There was no difficulty where there was no rocks. But when these plows were moved into the rocky territory, the glacial country up in North Dakota and Montana, South Dakota, those plows were torn up. When you move a plow at maybe 6 miles an hour across the ground, dripping down deep in the ground, and it catches onto a rock, it's immobile, something has to give, and it's going to be the plow. So there was an effort made to try to eliminate the breakage. Our client, Mr. Graham, did arrive at a structure that solved that problem. That was the 811 patent, as we call it. Then he wasn't satisfied. He continued his efforts and made the 798 patent. Now this 798 patent is shown in the particularly in figure 1 and 2 of the drawings on page 577.
Is it 577?
Yes, sir, Justice Clay. That is a rather unusual structure that was a complete change from anything that had been done before in the way of mounting the shank so it would flex and absorb all the shock that would happen when you struck a rock. The structure has a member that's fixed to the frame. Under that, there is a hinge-like member. It's pivoted to this fixed member. And mounted on that hinge member is the shank of the plow. The only connection between the shank and this hinge member is a bolt at the forward end of the plate of the hinge and the shank is coming back behind it. You can see here the forward end is a bolt. That leaves the shank free to move relative to the plate.
Which is the bolt in figure one? Which it's not how...
Mr. Justice Stewart, look at figure 2 right at the forward end, which would be at the right-hand side of the drawing. Number 55 refers to the bolt.
55? Where does it appear in figure 1?
It's still at the left-hand end of the figure, towards the lower part of the figure. There's a bolt right at the forward end or right-hand side.
I see.
Maybe I can help to show it by showing a chart. Here is the bolt. The green member is the hinge plate that's hinged on the blue pivot. The shank is colored in pink. Now when there is a bolt, a spring bolt at the forward end. It has a spring that tends to urge the shank and the plate up against the fixed member, and that's what we have referred to as home base position. Normal plowing would have the point of the plow in the ground and the spring hold this forward end up against the plate. Now, if you hit hard spots in the ground, there's going to be a tendency for the plate to hinge downwardly. And it will cause this spring here, this number 65, to compress. That allows an opening, you might say, of this hinge member. That will occur, and there will be some flexibility in the shank, some bending back behind the clamp. The main thing is when the point of this plow hits a rock. When that hits a rock, it's going to have to move up to go over the rock, and that can be done as the hinge is down here compressing this spring, and that will help to jump over this rock. If it doesn't completely jump it with the compression of this spring and the bending of the shank, then you can still have damage and shock. Our structure is such that when it's hinging up, it will flex down in this portion of the shank below that plate member. That is a flexibility that we say is different than anything that was ever made in the prior structures.
How did you do it in the structure?
In a patent in 1883, Mr. Justice Clark, there was a Ricks patent. There was also in the same year a Cobb patent, and it was, in our judgment, the same structure as was later made by Glencoe. And you will hear the respondent say that all we have done is turn over the shank and this hinge plate. That, in effect, is the difference. In the Glencoe structure, the shank is above the plate, but in such a way that when it flexes or when it swings up, the shank will be against the plate and it will tend to push it against it and keep it from flexing. It'll hold it down solid so that all the stress is back behind the plate. It gets then into a position such as we had with the fixed clamps, where this excessive bending in the back will cause stress and breakage of the shanks. Then they'll be on their elastic limit. They do have some bending above the shank, but Your Honor, please, there is a sketch in Volume 3 of the record. That would be Plaintiff's Exhibit W on page 653. That will tend to show a form of what would be similar to Ricks, Glencoe, and those prior patents. That particular sketch was a rough sketch to show an idea of what would happen with the old structures, and it in those, when it swung down, the stirrup or loop that goes over the shank forms a fulcrum. Now when the force is up on the left of the drawing in the rear of the clamp, it tends to force the forward end of the shank down against the plate of the hinge. As it forces it down, the bending is back at the rear of the clamp, so you have all of the excessive bending at that point. I would like to reserve some for rebuttal, sir.
You may. Mr. Morris.
Mr. Chief Justice and members of the court, let me answer quickly two or three statements that were made before we commence the formal presentation of our case. A question was asked of Mr. Gold concerning the test applied in the Eighth Circuit. And he read a statement from the opinion of the Eighth Circuit wherein the Eighth Circuit disapproved a rule which would find invention for mere improvement. As long ago as 1876, this court in Reckendorfer versus Faber said, perfection of workmanship, however much it may increase the convenience, extend the use, or diminish expense, is not patentable. That has been, I think, the consistent rule in this court from that day to this.
But he was talking about something else. He was talking about perfection of workmanship.
Well, the question asked is perfection of workmanship, improvement, increase of efficiency, economy. Those things, this court has always said, are not enough.
Well, if all you have is perfection of workmanship.
All right.
But that's beginning with the answer.
Now then, we will come to the answer of that specific question by analysis. My point here is to show that it has long been the rule of this court that mere perfection of workmanship, mere improvement, mere increased efficiency or economy is not enough for patentability. Now then, another remark counsel made, which I would like to answer specifically before turning to the body of the case. I believe he stated that he did not contend that Section 103 changed the law. And it's rather difficult to understand that statement when at page 23 of the brief he says, Congress in Section 101, 102, and 103 of the Patent Act of 1952 provided a statutory definition of the requirements of patentability. This was a change from the standards of invention of the judicial opinions expressed in the decades immediately preceding the Patent Act of 1952. The Patent Act was the expression of the clear intent by Congress to return or restore the old requirements laid down in Hotchkiss versus Greenwood. My point simply is, and I believe we have traced it in chronological order through the brief, that since Hotchkiss versus Greenwood, right straight down through the last expression of this court in A&P, the rule has been to determine patentability in a combination of old elements case. The question has been whether or not the combination amounts to an advance beyond that which would be expected of a person having ordinary skill in the art. And I say to the court that that's exactly what Section 103 says. There may be some change in the language of it, but there cannot be any change in the meaning of it. I think all of the circuits, with the exception of the Second Circuit and two decisions by Justice Learned Hand, have reached that conclusion. And I believe that in following the history of it, the position is irrefutable that that is what Section 103 means. That's what Congress said in the committee reports, and with one or two exceptions.
Well, Mr. Morris, how about the Eighth Circuit's test? Let's assume the Eighth Circuit had said that the test, where there's an old, with a combination of old elements, is whether a new result is produced.
I don't think the Eighth Circuit has said that necessarily, Your Honor.
I didn't say it did. I said assume it did. Is that wrong?
Let me address myself to that specific problem, because it's an excellent question. It gets us down to the heart of the problem. Now, we can phrase a test any way we want to. When you come to apply it to specific factual situations, as the court said, as Mr. Justice Jackson said in the A&P case, and Mr. Justice Douglas said in his concurring opinion there, as was said in several of the cases prior to that time, when you come to a combination situation where there is nothing new, there is no new element, no new mechanical element, and all that is new, if there is anything new, is merely in the arrangement, the particular combination of those mechanical elements, then how do you determine whether or not it is above and beyond the expected skill of the ordinary man having normal and expected capacity in the industry? And this court has said, when you come to that situation, in Lincoln Engineering, for example, it said it's not enough if all it does is produce an old result in a more efficient way. And in A&P, it said, only in that type of case can it amount to invention. Can it be an advance beyond the expected skill of the art? If it does produce some new, unexpected, or surprising result or consequence, some new, unexpected, or surprising function of a part or combined functions of parts. That's what the Eighth Circuit is saying. It is merely saying the same thing this court said in A and P.
So obviousness is one test of obviousness is whether there's a new result or not.
One test of obviousness as applied to this narrow area, the narrow area of a combination of old elements. And if it does produce a new, unpredictable, unexpected consequence, then it may amount to invention. I think that's all the Eighth Circuit is saying.
Even if the new arrangement is, let's say, obvious?
Well, you would have a good question there. If the arrangement was obvious, and that might be true, that's
might,
not...
It might produce a very new result.
It might produce a new result. For example, I think in one of the cases coming up after ours, at least there's certainly a contention on the part of the patentee that while the arrangement might have been obvious, the result was wholly unexpected and even unexplainable. The experts don't even know. And it may be, I don't know the record in that case,
yeah,
it may be that that's...
Producing a new result is different from producing a non-obvious result.
Is it? Is non-obvious anything different from new?
Well, the Act seemed to treat new and obvious as different.
Do the words which we use in defining it really mean anything? Do they really get us any closer to solving the issue in the given case of whether or not this is an advance beyond the expected skill of the calling, which entitles a person to a statutory monopoly for 17 years.
Are you suggesting that novelty and invention are the same
thing? Synonymous? Not by any means, Your Honor. Certainly there can be something novel. In this case, we have no hesitation in saying that the 798 arrangement is novel in the sense that you can't find a picture of it in the prior art. There are some different little arrangements which are spelled out with picture words in the claims. And consequently, since you can't point to another patent which shows it precisely, it's novel in the sense as defined in Section 102 of the statute. We don't challenge that.
I want to be sure that I understand your answer to my brother White's question. He said, assuming that the Eighth Circuit unambiguously and explicitly said that one of the distinct, discrete requirements of patentability is that in the case of a mechanical combination patent of old elements, is that the device produce a new result. Is that would you say that's a correct statement of the law?
I would say that is more narrow, perhaps, than is necessary to state the rule of law. Now, I think that is precisely what this court said in A and P.
Well, no, you don't. I can't find that, at least, in the statute, in Section 101, Section 102, or Section 103. And earlier you told us that the statute codified the case law.
Well, it's a matter of trying to apply the basic test to the specific problem. The broad and basic test is the expected something beyond the expected skill of the calling, as it's been stated in the cases all the way through, or, as it's stated in the statute, non-obvious. Now then.
Well, those are two different, to me, those have two different meanings, those two phrases. For something which produces a new result and something which was not obvious. They may or may not overlap in any given patent.
Well, that is entirely true. I think that's maybe a correct statement as applied to a specific case. As Mr. Justice White posed the question a moment ago, you may have a situation where you could say that the arrangement would have been obvious to one having skill in the art, yet the result was unexpected. That might be true. In another situation, it might be possible to say that the arrangement or the combination would be unobvious, though it's rather difficult for me to imagine a case of that kind where you're dealing with everyday stock of mechanical elements. Now, if I may, let me turn the court's attention to the patent here in issue. I know that this patent is not of any great national significance, yet nevertheless, these questions must be decided in the context of the facts and the patent that's before the court. Let's see what happened here. Let's see what the problem was and what was done. Now, let's eliminate a little chaff, too, before we start. This is a spring clamp for attaching the shank of a groundworking tool to the frame of a plow so that it may pivot under forces from rocks or other obstructions in the soil and return to operating position by means of a spring. Now, in simple language, that's all it is. Now, the first thing I want to make absolutely clear is that's not new with this patent. That goes back, that business of a spring clamp for resiliently attaching a shank to the frame of a tool is at least since 1875. It goes back at least that far. There's not any new plowing result here. This is a chisel plow. Chisel plows, in the modern sense, at least go back to 1935. Spring clamps for chisel plows at least go back to 1946 or 47. So this didn't bring about a new plowing result. It was not a new idea on the mounting of a shank. It was not a new spring clamp for a chisel plow. None of those broad things were present here or accomplished here. And in order to find anything inventive or that might even approach inventiveness in this case, we have to come down to the elements that are involved and their arrangements and their accomplishments. Now, here again, let's eliminate chaff. It is conceded and found that every single mechanical element here is old, and that couldn't be... There couldn't be any question about that. They're at least 75 years old in this particular art. There isn't even any contention, nor could there be any contention here, that this is the first time all of these elements had been combined in a spring clamp for a chisel plow, because that had all been done by Mr. Roth and the Glencoe clamp at least 2 years earlier than Mr. Graham by stipulation. So what is it here? And the only way you can answer that question, I think, is to look at it from the standpoint of the problem. And let's examine. Mr. Graham had an old spring clamp, which is called 811, working on these plows for these shanks. And he had some problems with it. He had some wear problems with it. He had a rather unusual arrangement in that the shank pivoted about a point on the heel of the clamp rather than around its pivot pin. And also, he didn't have a true fastening means to fasten his shank to his hinge member so that there was a sliding movement as the thing worked. Well, he had two problems of wear, one at the rear where the shank scrubbed on the butt of his clamp and one at the front where it pulled on his spring rod. So what did he do? He set out to solve that problem, those problems. He turned his hinge member upside down and fastened it together with a bolt at the front and a loop underneath to hold it up at the rear. Now, that's what he did. Nothing else. You can study this record, and you can phrase it any way you want to, and that's all you can make of it. He took these old elements, which were ready available right there in the art, and rearranged them slightly. And that's all. Now, then, what did that accomplish? Well, first of all, let's address ourselves to the obviousness of that question, of the structure itself, aside from what happened to it. Now, if you have a shank which pivots about a point, and it's rubbing at that point, what would be the obvious and common sense thing for anybody to do? It would be to put a pivotal bearing there, wouldn't it? To eliminate the rubbing contact, instead of a sliding pivot to have a full pivot, an ordinary full pivot. That's what he did. That's what the art did. That's what was used in all of the art except his own 811 patent. All right, his other problem was the slipping and sliding of his shank and the pulling on his spring rod, which caused the wear at the front. But what would be the obvious answer to that if you have one spring rod coming through here which carries all this big thrust of the shank as it works back and forth? And that binds his spring rod so that it can't go up and down as he wants it to carry the spring pressure. What would you do? What would anybody do? Fasten them together to take the load off the spring rod. Well, now, when he did those two things, he accomplished his wear reduction as related to his 811 clamp, his old clamp. Yes, he improved his old 811 clamp. He reduced some wear. But that had been fully accomplished in the Glencoe clamp. Glencoe had a rotating pivot. Glencoe had a hinge member, which did exactly that same thing. Glencoe had fastened the shank to the hinge member to take pulling load off the spring clamp before Graham did. So not only did he use the obvious, aside from any art, in addition to that, those things were taught in the very art in which he was working. Now, I'm not overlooking what he now asserts in the courthouse as the heart of his inventive concept. I've left that because it must be dealt with and it must be destroyed as the Eighth Circuit destroyed it. He says now, and this is never raised or mentioned in the patent office, it's not mentioned in the specifications of the patent, it's not mentioned in the file wrapper history or proceedings before the patent office, it's not mentioned in the claims, but in the courthouse now he says, yes, but when I turn the plate and the shank upside down, that permits my shank to bend down away from the plate in this area where it contacts the plate, and that makes a more resilient, shock-absorbing structure than I had before, and consequently, that is a new accomplishment. That is a significant consequence which entitles me to a patent. Well, in the first place, I think it's rather strange that if that was such an important feature, that it would never have been mentioned at all until it got to the courthouse. And you can search the record from front to back, and that's you'll see that it's never been mentioned until it got to the courthouse. And it also strikes me as strange that that could be relied upon as a feature of importance to sustain this patent, an accomplishment, an advance beyond the expected skill of the art, an unobvious result, if you please, or an unobvious structure, if you please, which would entitle him to a patent when his own expert says, quote, "Do you regard the small degree of flex in the forward end of the shank that lies between the pivot point and the point of spring attachment to be of any significance or any importance to the functioning of a device such as 798? Answer, unless you're approaching the elastic limit, I think the flexing will reduce the maximum stress at the point of pivot there where the maximum stress does occur. I think it will reduce that. I don't know how much. Question, do you think it is a substantial factor, a factor of importance in the functioning of the structure? Answer, not a great factor, no. And in the Jeffrey case, which had been tried sometime earlier, a similar testimony was given and is also reported in this record. Do you consider this portion that you call the resilient action of the shank, Mr. Fenton, in the forward 8 or 9 inches that's up inside the mounting of the bracket important to the function of the device? Answer, not too important. It's present, but it's not too important. Question, it would function just as well whether that were there or not, wouldn't it? Answer, in this particular case with this device? Yes, sir. Question, I think it would. Essentially, yes. So, this great important thing that's been the advance beyond the art now, even his own expert says it's unimportant. Well, now, looking at this device, in summation of what was done and what was accomplished, it didn't change the way it plowed. It didn't change the way it pivoted, except that it pivoted around a bearing instead of a point. It didn't change the action of the shank. It didn't change the plowing result. It didn't change the main body of the clamp. It didn't change the springs. It didn't change anything except the relative position of the shank and the hinge member and the fastening means. And that's all. Now, if that be invention, if that be an advance, which any court will say would entitle a man to a 17-year monopoly, then it seems to me that we have gone a long way down the road of destroying any validity of the patent system. Now let me turn my attention, or if I may, to the history of this litigation just a bit. Of course, we recognize that we have here a former decisions of the Fifth Circuit upholding this patent twice. But I don't think there can be any doubt whatsoever about the basis of validity in the Fifth Circuit. You can search both opinions in the first of the Jeffrey cases and in the Cockshut case, both of which I've set out in principal part in the brief, to find the basis for the holding of validity in the Fifth Circuit, and you can come up with only one conclusion. And that is that the patent was sustained in the Fifth Circuit because it produced, as it thought, a more efficient, a more economic result. Listen to these words. It still seems to us that its hybrid-type structure, combining the wear-resisting rotating pivot, in part reminiscent of the prior art, with the new shank and stirrup arrangement, permitting some of the same advantageous flexibility inherent in the old 811 structure, reveals sufficient indicia of novelty and invention to justify limited protection. The further rule, and this is the only place you can find anything that looks like a rule in that opinion, the further rule, long recognized by this court, that an improvement combination is patentable, even though its constituent elements are singly revealed by the prior art, whereas here it produces an old result in a cheaper and otherwise more advantageous way. And if that weren't enough to establish what the real rule is, look on to the Cockshut case, which followed some 3 years later, and the court said this: it is only because this particular arrangement of these known elements adopted by Graham achieves the result better than the prior art afforded, better than the prior art afforded, that Graham was entitled to a patent. That's the rule in the Fifth Circuit. There was no attempt to follow the statute. There was no attempt to apply the rule.
What does the statute say about result, one way or the other?
Doesn't say anything at all about it.
Well, then, so...
Well, was there any...
It's not quite right that there was no attempt to follow the statute.
Your Honor, was there any...
We're a little off in talking about results, as far as the statute goes. Isn't that correct? Both courts, both the Fifth Circuit and the Eighth Circuit.
I don't quite understand. Well, no, sir, Your Honor, that's not true. As I construe the opinions, in the first place, you'll not find any attempt in the Fifth Circuit to apply any standard of the statute or prior cases or anything except its own old standard of a better result or an improved result. Now, let me turn quickly to this problem.
Well,
here.
As I read what you said from the Fifth Circuit, they weren't talking about a new result. They were talking about achieving an old result in a new or more efficient way.
That's exactly what I said. I believe that's the way I read it, and I say that wrong. That doesn't follow anybody's test. It doesn't follow the test laid down by this court or by the statute or any other test. It's the only circuit that I know anything about that says that a better result alone is now enough, is enough. That's the only court I know of that says such a rule as that. Now, turning to the Eighth Circuit, if I may, I'd like to direct the court's attention to the square and true and complete holding of the Eighth Circuit, and let's not pick it to tidbits, to find out what the true context is. Here's what the court said. Furthermore, even assuming that the trial court's finding of a slight but significant difference in the flexing of the forward portion of the shank that is not found in the prior art can be construed as a finding of a new result, the court's further finding, I want the court to follow this, the court's further finding that patent 798 exhibits invention and would not have been obvious to a person having ordinary skill in the art is clearly erroneous. The alleged patentable difference between the 798 structure and the prior art lies in the arrangement in the 798 structure of the shank below the plate of the pivoted member, permitting the shank to flex throughout its length, and particularly permitting the forward portion of the shank to flex downwardly away from the plate. Theoretically, and listen to this, theoretically at least, when the plate is below the shank, as in the prior art, there is a tendency of the shank to bend against the plate. And when the plate is above, as in 798, there is a tendency of the shank to bend away from the plate. And let me stop there and direct our attention to the question again of obviousness under the statute. If the plate lies underneath the shank in the prior art, and the shank bends downwardly against the plate, what will happen if you change the positions and move the plate above, retaining a fulcrum point above, as is was done here? What's going to happen? Which way can it bend? The only way, and the obvious way, is it will now bend away from the plate instead of toward it. Is that predictable? Is that the expected? Is that what any high school physics student would say would happen? By any imagination, can that be construed as an unexpected a structure or an unexpected result, an unobvious thing? Let's finish then with what the Eighth Circuit said about this fact. But is this difference, it pointed out the difference in the bending, but is this difference significant enough to support the patent? We think not. Painstaking examination of the entire record, including the testimony of the experts, convinces us that the changes in the prior art embodied in 798 involve only the application of mechanical ability. There's no adequate evidentiary support for the court's findings, and going on it says, and would have been obvious to a person having ordinary skill in the art. Let me sum up by bringing in some other ancillary things. Frequently, if a case is a close case, the courts rely upon these make-weights. I call them validity crutches in the brief. Such things as commercial success, long-felt want, inability of others to solve the problem, immediate solving of the problem by this device, immediate copying and adoption by others, none of which are present in this case. Graham has never manufactured or sold this device at all, regardless of what he says about its merits. In all these years, he's never done it. There is the only commercial success was commercial success achieved by Jeffrey Manufacturing Company, who were on the market with their device more than a year prior to the time this patent even issued. There's no finding of any copying in this case by anybody. As a matter of fact, the only way that there was a finding of infringement in the trial court was upon the doctrine of equivalence, not because the claims of the patent could be read upon these devices. There's no evidence of any long-felt want here. When the problem arose, it was solved immediately by some sketching and the filing of a patent application. There's no evidence here of any long experimentation or wrestling with a tough problem. It just didn't exist. I say to the court that this patent represents a derelict, which the Eighth Circuit, after a full and careful review, has said is not entitled to stand. And under the record, the undisputed facts in this case, the achievement of this device, if there is any at all, is so nominal and so clear and would have been so obvious to even a high school physics student that it simply is not entitled to a statutory monopoly for 17 years or any other years.
May I ask you if there's a picture of the plow with the equipment anywhere? I'm not talking about this map, this diagram, and the application of the patent.
Your Honor, I think you will find in the record several brochures and so on that are in the fifth volume. There are some pictures probably in there, although I can't put my hand on any right off the bat.
Well, now that both of you have argued it, would you mind telling me in plain layman's language, if you can, exactly what the plow was before and what it became after?
Yes, sir, I certainly can, easily.
Not according to any artistic language used in getting
plain the patent. Plain and simple as I know how, Your Honor. The plow is what's called a chisel plow. It consists of a mobile frame. In other words, a frame mounted on wheels, drawn by a tractor.
It's always drawn by a tractor?
Always drawn by a tractor in modern times, although it could be small enough for horses, I suppose, but a tractor. It has multiple cross beams to which multiple ground working spring shanks are attached.
What do you mean by multiple cross beams?
It has three of them, generally speaking. There's the plow is drawn this way by the tractor. It has two or three cross beams or transverse beams, transverse to the direction the plow travels. And on these beams, that's the frame of the plow.
That's the frame. And on the beams of...
On the beams are mounted shanks that come back and curve and work the soil.
That's what goes in the soil. Is that it?
That's a type. That's not the precise one, Your Honor. That's a forerunner.
Is this in here?
Is there one of them in here anyway?
Well, I think if you look at page 819, you'll see a picture of the Jeffrey plow, which is a substantially similar plow. There's a brochure there showing the arrangements. 818 and 819, Your Honor, there are pictures there. Also 821, so. Now to complete my definition.
Down underneath and...
All right.
You go in the ground.
Now then,
the old-fashioned plow.
That's the old-fashioned plow, except the reason this is... Excuse me.
Down with the thing that goes in the ground.
All right, that's, generally speaking, these plows use what's called a chisel point, and that's where the name chiseling comes from. It's a sharp type of tool that's designed to penetrate the ground, go through and break the hard pan, or supposed to. Now, that's the groundworking element. But the heart of this lawsuit now is not that plow. That's an ancient thing. The heart of this lawsuit is the clamps which attach those groundworking elements to the frame.
Well, now, we've got the plow. That's the way it was.
All right.
And the claim of improvement is that they, as I understand it, see if I'm wrong, that when the old plow would get at a rock or something stubborn, it wasn't flexible. It wouldn't give like it should. Is that the idea? It wouldn't give.
That's correct.
And they wanted to discover some way to make it give. And work some way to make it give so that it move over.
Right.
And what's been done here is...
But, Your Honor, may I interrupt you? Because you're leaving out a crucial and important step. This manufacturer or devising of a spring clamp to do that job, that is to let the shank pivot and return to action, is old. It wasn't done first with Graham and this patent. It has been done for years. It was done in an earlier Graham patent as applied to earlier plows in 1947. It was done by Jeffrey. It was done by other people. So this patent involves merely an improvement of a prior spring clamp which performed that job.
Well, now, does it make it give better? What does it do?
Well,
in layman's language,
I
can't understand it. Sir.
Your Honor, if you can search this record and find any testimony in the record which will show you anything that it does other than this little reduction in wear and other than this so-called difference in the flexing.
Well, what's the difference in the flexing? Does it?
The difference is that...
When the farmer gets hold of it.
Doesn't make any difference at all when the farmer gets hold of it. It's immaterial.
He's the one that's doing the plowing.
Sir?
He's the one that's doing the plowing.
Well,
what does he get out of it when he gets this
nothing,
new improvement?
Nothing. Not only that, I defy that it even exists beyond such an infinitesimal amount that it's not even measurable. Some efforts were made to measure the thing. These shanks swing back 12, 13 inches when they're coming clear of those rocks. The flex that they're talking about in this shank, the maximum that anybody has been able to measure it, is about 35 thousandths of an inch. 35 thousandths of an inch.
It flexes 35 thousandths of an inch different.
35 thousandths of an inch away from this pivoted member, different from what it was before. Now, that's it. Now, a farmer would never know anything.
You say that's all the difference in it?
Your Honor, you can search this record, and that's all there is. That's all the trial court found as a basis to support this patent.
Well, now, what advantage does the farmer get out of this?
Oh, the advantage and the only advantage is one which is the figment of counsel's imagination, and that is...
Well, of course, he's not a farmer. What I want to know is what the farmer looking at it. What the farmer looking at it, reusing it, would find he had a benefit.
He'll find none, Your Honor. and it's never been proven that there is any by any farmer. There's no farmer anywhere has ever testified that it does anything.
What did the Fifth Circuit say it did?
The Fifth Circuit says it reduces wear.
Who wrote that opinion?
I believe Mr. Justice Reeves wrote that opinion,
yeah.
Wrote the first of the opinions.
Who wrote the second?
You've got me. I don't remember.
Well, why does the respondent want to use it if it doesn't
Your Honor, you're assuming something that hasn't been decided, and that is that we want to use it. We say to you that when we came to design our clamp, the patent had been issued. We didn't copy that clamp. We deliberately set about to design around that patent. We made a careful search. Everything that was done was carefully checked and tested. We studied this patent to determine what its heart was, and we avoided that patent. Now, the trial court found that we infringed.
Now,
the Eighth Circuit didn't reach that point.
Why did the trial court find you infringed? In what? And why do you say that's wrong?
Well, Your Honor, that's another long, long story.
Well, I don't want to know.
You see,
the claims are too long for me.
Well, now, they're really not. Let me call to your attention something that is... Well, this could go forever, and I've already used my time. But the court's question goes to the...
Well, I don't want to get a lot of time. I just wanted to see if I could get a picture.
All right, let me read you what...
What it did and what it didn't do.
Let me read you what the claim itself says about the relationship of this pivoted member and this shank. And of coming down to the element, the one element where it would be. Claim one says... means connecting the elongated plate portion, that's the hinge member, with the shank for maintaining the upper face of the shank in constant, continuous contact with the underface of said plate portion of
the
shank attaching member.
With the what?
For maintaining constant, continuous contact with the underface of said plate portion of the shank attaching member.
Does that mean all? Does that mean fasten it to it, turn it somewhere?
That's what it means to me, Your Honor. It says connect means connecting for constant, continuous contact.
And that's the bolt we've been hearing about.
That's the bolt connected. And the stirrup at the rear through which the shank passes. And yet here, that's what the claim says. Yet the argument is that the secret to it, the heart of the improvement, is that it bends away from it. Here it says, means maintaining constant, continuous contact. I've more than used my time, and I hope I haven't exhausted the court's patience.
Mr. Gold?
Chief Justice, please. I would like to make one comment first. The respondent's attorney has indicated that the respondent didn't care about making this device, they designed around it. The record shows that the respondent was making what was called a pigtail shank type of plow, where it had a coil in the shank behind the clamp. Other than that, it was a fixed clamp. And that is a device that was shown in the record in the catalogs that they put out when they first started. But they weren't satisfied with that type of device because it wasn't selling.
Wasn't what?
It wasn't selling. The market was gone to Graham and Jeffrey and these other small companies. They sent men out into the field and made surveys. Those surveys are in the record. There were two of them. One started at page 799. The other one started at page 823. There were extensive surveys made of the plows that were in the field. They were familiar with the surveys. One was the Defendant's Exhibit 30, starting on record page 799.
You said they made the surveys.
Respondents, John Deere. They made a second survey, and it started on page 823 of the record. Those are rather extensive surveys, Mr. Justice Black. In addition to that, they made up a prototype and sent drawings of that prototype to their patent department and got letters back telling them that their device infringed the 798 patent. So with full knowledge of the patent, they still designed one like it. They still wanted to use it. They were found by their own people that they infringed. They went back and changed two little tiny parts by putting a little bit of metal on it so it would contact the frame instead of the fixed member that was fastened rigidly to the frame. Just a little bit of point difference in contact. They said, we are out of the range of the claims. We're free. We can use the idea. I think that the record clearly indicates that they did want to use this structure. I would like to make one other comment or two, if I may. There was a contention that this was something that was brought forth in the courthouse. The patent disclosed the structure. There was no contention any place that it didn't teach how to make it. And I believe that that's all the statute requires us to do in describing an invention. We must disclose it so that it is sufficient for others to make it. And that was the case here. And we feel that you don't necessarily describe all the functions. You certainly don't claim functions. That has been criticized in the past. You claim structure. We did that in this case. Thank you very much.